Chapter 84. Nicholas drew a card from his pocket and threw it before him. "There, sir," apostrophe said Nicholas. "My business, you will guess." Apostrophe, a momentary expression of astonishment, not unmixed with some confusion, appeared in the face of Sir Mulberry as he read the name, but he subdued it in an instant, and tossing the card to Lord Verisopht, who sat opposite, drew a toothpick from a glass before him, and very leisurely applied it to his mouth. "Your name and address?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, said Nicholas, turning paler as his passion kindled. "I shall give you neither," apostrophe, replied Sir Mulberry. "If there is a gentleman in this party," apostrophe, said Nicholas, looking round and scarcely able to make his white lips form the words, "he will acquaint me with the name and residence of this man." Apostrophe, there was a dead silence. "I am the brother of the young lady who has been the subject of conversation here," apostrophe, said Nicholas. "I denounce this person as a liar, and impeach him as a coward. If he has a friend here, he will save him the disgrace of the paltry attempt to conceal his name and utterly useless one, for I will find it out, nor leave him until I have." Apostrophe, Sir Mulberry looked at him contemptuously, and, addressing his companions, said, "Let the fellow talk. I have nothing serious to say to boys of his station, and his pretty sister shall save him a broken head if he talks till midnight." Apostrophe, you are a base and spiritless scoundrel. Apostrophe, apostrophe, said Nicholas, and shall be proclaimed so to the world. I will know you. I will follow you home, if you walk the streets till morning. Apostrophe, Sir Mulberry's hand involuntarily closed upon the decanter, and he seemed for an instant about to launch it at the head of his challenger. But he only filled his glass, and laughed in derision. Nicholas sat himself down, directly opposite to the party, and, summoning the waiter, paid his bill. "Do you know that person's name?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, he inquired of the man in an audible voice, pointing out Sir Mulberry as he put the question. Sir Mulberry laughed again, and the two voices which had always spoken together echoed the laugh, but rather feebly. "That gentleman, sir?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, replied the waiter, who, no doubt, knew his cue, and answered with just as little respect, and just as much impertinence as he could safely show. "No, sir, I do not, sir." Apostrophe, hear you, sir, apostrophe, cried Sir Mulberry, as the man was retiring. "Do you know that person's name?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, name, sir? "No, sir." Apostrophe, then you will find it there, apostrophe, said Sir Mulberry, throwing Nicholas's card towards him, "and when you have made yourself master of it, put that piece of pasteboard in the fire, do you hear me?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, the man grinned, and, looking doubtfully at Nicholas, calm promised the matter by sticking the card in the chimney glass. Having done this, he retired. Nicholas folded his arms, and biting his lip, sat perfectly quiet, sufficiently expressing by his manner, however, a firm determination to carry his threat of following Sir Mulberry home into steady execution. It was evident from the tone in which the younger member of the party appeared to remonstrate with his friend that he objected to this course of proceeding, and urged him to comply with the request which Nicholas had made. Sir Mulberry, however, who was not quite sober, and who was in a sullen and dogged state of obstinacy, soon silenced the representations of his weak young friend, and further seemed as if to save himself from a repetition of them to insist on being left alone. However this might have been, the young gentleman and the two who had always spoken together actually rose to go after a short interval, and presently retired, leaving their friend alone with Nicholas. It will be very readily supposed that to one in the condition of Nicholas, the minutes appeared to move with leaden wings indeed, and that their progress did not seem the more rapid from the monotonous ticking of a French clock, or the shrill sound of its little bell which told the quarters. But there he sat, and in his old seat on the opposite side of the room reclined Sir Mulberry Hawk, with his legs upon the cushion, and his handkerchief thrown negligently over his knees, finishing his magnum of claret with the utmost coolness and indifference. Thus they remained in perfect silence for upwards of an hour. Nicholas would have thought for 3 hours at least, but that the little bell had only gone four times. Twice or thrice he looked angrily and impatiently round, but there was Sir Mulberry in the same attitude, putting his glass to his lips from time to time, and looking vacantly at the wall, as if he were wholly ignorant of the presence of any living person. At length he yawned, stretched himself, and rose, walked coolly to the glass, and having surveyed himself there, turned round and honored Nicholas with a long and contemptuous stare. Nicholas stared again with right goodwill. Sir Mulberry shrugged his shoulders, smiled slightly, rang the bell, and ordered the waiter to help him on with his greatcoat. The man did so, and held the door open. "Don't wait," said Sir Mulberry, and they were alone again. Sir Mulberry took several turns up and down the room, whistling carelessly all the time, stopped to finish the last glass of claret which he had poured out a few minutes before, walked again, put on his hat, adjusted it by the glass, drew on his gloves, and, at last, walked slowly out. Nicholas, who had been fuming and chafing until he was nearly wild, darted from his seat, and followed him, so closely, that before the door had swung upon its hinges after Sir Mulberry's passing out, they stood side by side in the street together. There was a private cabriolet in waiting. The groom opened the apron, and jumped out to the horse's head. "Will you make yourself known to me?" asked Nicholas in a suppressed voice. "No," replied the other fiercely, and confirming the refusal with an oath. "No. If you trust to your horse's speed, you will find yourself mistaken," said Nicholas. "I will accompany you. By heaven I will, if I hang on to the footboard. You shall be horsewhipped if you do," returned Sir Mulberry. "You are a villain," said Nicholas. "You are an errand boy for aught I know," said Sir Mulberry Hawk. "I am the son of a country gentleman," returned Nicholas, "your equal in birth and education, and your superior I trust in everything besides. I tell you again, Miss Nickleby is my sister. Will you or will you not answer for your unmanly and brutal conduct?" "To a proper champion, yes. Do you know," returned Sir Mulberry, taking the reins in his hand, "stand out of the way, dog. William, let go her head." "You had better not," cried Nicholas, springing on the step as Sir Mulberry jumped in, and catching at the reins. "He has no command over the horse, mind. You shall not go, you shall not, I swear, till you have told me who you are." The groom hesitated, for the mare, who was a high-spirited animal and thoroughbred, plunged so violently that he could scarcely hold her. "Leave go, I tell you," thundered his master. The man obeyed. The animal reared and plunged, as though it would dash the carriage into a thousand pieces, but Nicholas, blind to all sense of danger, and conscious of nothing but his fury, still maintained his place and his hold upon the reins. "Will you unclasp your hand? Will you tell me who you are? No. No. In less time than the quickest tongue could tell it, these words were exchanged, and Sir Mulberry, shortening his whip, applied it furiously to the head and shoulders of Nicholas. It was broken in the struggle. Nicholas gained the heavy handle, and with it laid open one side of his antagonist's face from the eye to the lip. He saw the gash, knew that the mare had darted off at a wild mad gallop, a hundred lights danced in his eyes, and he felt himself flung violently upon the ground. He was giddy and sick, but staggered to his feet directly, roused by the loud shouts of the men who were tearing up the street, and screaming to those ahead to clear the way. He was conscious of a torrent of people rushing quickly by looking up, could discern the cabriolet whirled along the foot pavement with frightful rapidity, then heard a loud cry, the smashing of some heavy body, and the breaking of glass, and then the crowd closed in the distance, and he could see or hear no more. The general attention had been entirely directed from himself to the person in the carriage, and he was quite alone. Rightly judging that under such circumstances it would be madness to follow, he turned down a by street in search of the nearest coach stand, finding after a minute or two that he was reeling like a drunken man, and aware for the first time of a stream of blood that was trickling down his face and breast. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.